There we go. All right, good afternoon. Welcome. We're opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 7th, 2015. Just so everyone knows what the agenda is, we are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2960 in a moment. And those folks who had an opportunity to sign in yesterday, I'm going to call you in that order. In addition, there's a sign-up sheet right over there. Julie, we're good on that? Right over there? And so if you need to sign in, let us know. Here's what I'm going to do, because I also have two other work sessions we're going to have to do after this. So we're going to run a pretty tight gavel today, if that's all right. Representative, come on up. If you could share your thoughts. And then other folks, I'm going to limit comments to 3 minutes. Okay, so I'm not meaning to cut anyone off, but we'll have 3 minutes. Representative, you have all the time you want. All right, so I'm going to...
I don't think it'll take me 3 minutes.
All right.
Don't go that far.
So I'm opening up our public hearing on House Bill 2960. Welcome, Representative.
Well, thank you, Representative Co-Chair Smith and representatives of the committee. My name is Greg Barreto, representative for House District 58. And actually, this is on fairly short notice to testify today. I just heard about this meeting and was asked to testify on it on House Bill 2960. We worked this bill in our Business and Labor Committee earlier in the year, and I had to go back and get a few notes out just to remember exactly what we discussed. And it came out of the committee on a partisan vote. But there was some information, and I understand that Elise Brown is going to give more information on this MIRA account. But it seemed to me, as we were listening to testimony on this House bill for the retirement plan, that it was a plan that basically was an outline. It hadn't been worked through in any details, and we were to vote on this bill so that it would become something after we actually voted to pass it. And I wrestled with that, and especially when there's already a system out there called the MIRA account that was set up exactly for this particular purpose, and it's a federal account, and it doesn't have a great return on it. But what it does is it allows the employee to start up a retirement account with absolutely nothing down. And I was going to read just a little bit on the on why it was developed. And this is I think the Obama administration that came up with this, but it says, why was the MIRA developed? There are millions of workers in America who either don't have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan or lack options to save for retirement. In some cases, they don't even have enough money saved to meet a minimum for opening an investment account. The U.S. Treasury developed the MIRA to address some of these common barriers to retirement saving and to provide a retirement savings option that is simple, safe, and affordable for savers. Although anyone eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA can use a MIRA to save for retirement, the program is especially designed for individuals without access to employer-sponsored retirement savings plans. It's not a replacement for 401ks or other types of employer-sponsored retirement plans. And yet what it does is a lot of IRAs require a certain amount just to get invested. And what it does is it's a go-between so that they can start with nothing, start adding to this account, get a return on it, and then when it builds up to a certain point, then they can take that and turn it over into an IRA that returns much better. And so my idea of this is that the state, you know, and I have to say, Treasurer Ted Wheeler has put a lot of time into this. I think there's a reason, a good reason for it. It's a valid effort that he's done. I think his intentions were right. My question is, does the state need to get into this when there's already a system out there that is much simpler, could be adapted over, and we could just use this vehicle to jumpstart this retirement system for those who don't have employer-funded system. So that's basically my pitch.
Perfect. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Smith, and members of the Ways and Means Committee. I'm here to filibuster for the next 3 hours on this bill. And,
if filibuster means 3 minutes, you're set.
So, You know, I want to follow up on what Representative Barreto was saying. You know, I want to thank the treasurer and his office for reaching out and working with me during this process. I am 100% behind the intent of the treasurer and what he's trying to do here. And I had some amendments for this. I didn't realize how far along the treasurer was in this, and he was very invested in the program that he had put together. But I brought some amendments together that where I was trying to get the business community, everybody on board with it. And I was looking at what made a difference for people outside of here. I mean, we have so many people that are retiring right now on just Social Security. They don't have enough to follow up with it. And I had an amendment in there, and it was the dash 7, and we're trying to get it up on OLIS for you right now. It'll be the dash 14A, but essentially is what I wanted to do is take care of the sick leave issues that we were dealing with when we were in committee, because we had the sick leave pay bill that was in there where employers paid. You had a lot of the business community who was against that, especially the small businesses. And the amendments I had were the dash 7 amendments, which basically we worked with the employment division, and a person would have 3% taking out of their check. They could opt in or opt out of this program, and they could save money through a sick leave program, and they withdraw it through sick leave. So if somebody puts in the 3% over the next 20 years, they never take a sick day off, they have $300,000, $500,000 in this account, and then all of a sudden at 45, 50 years old, you come down with cancer, you want to say, you know what, I'm going to take a year off work. You can take a year off work, and you have the money there to basically support you and go through that, or if your spouse gets sick or anything like that. So that was the whole intent behind my amendment when we started drafting it. You get sick for a week, you need to take time off from work, you can draw it there. But it's an account that just keeps accumulating for you, and it's dispersed through the employment department. Or they could use a third-party vendor. They would come up with the conclusion on how to put that together and bring it back to us for approval. We really didn't get a lot of time on that. I mean, the treasurer was in my office. We talked for an hour on this, and he was very invested where he was at. The problem I had with treasurer's bill, it wasn't really pulling the business community in and getting them on board and supporting this. And I was trying to come up with an easy solution that was great for Oregonians, great for business, so everybody won all the way across the board. We had support from the business community behind it. You get out here and you talk to everybody who works, all of my friends that are in the working industry outside of here that have the day-to-day job, the 9-to-5. They love the concept because now, you know what, I never get sick. I'm going to let it build up. Then if something major happens, I have money there. Problem I have with going with 401k, all of a sudden you have this money going into it the way the treasurer has it set up. Well, I get behind on bills and everything, and debt collectors call me. I go cash in that 401k, and now I get hit with huge penalties from the government, lost everything that I had accumulating there, and I've used it to pay off bills, and I'm back at square one. With doing the sick leave policy and the small amount that I was looking at doing, you only take it out if you're sick. Yes, you can abuse it, but most people are going to start talking and say, you know what, I got $50,000, $100,000 in my sick leave account. And they start letting it accumulate. So if you're just off sick for a day and you don't need the money, you're not going to file a claim against your sick leave. So you wouldn't ever draw it, and it keeps accumulating. And the reason I push this, we have a lot of Oregonians, young Oregonians, that may not have the Social Security system there. This is something that's going to supplement your 401k. It's going to supplement your Social Security. And I don't want them to look at it as a retirement account. I don't want employers to get rid of the 401ks they have. With the system we're putting in place, a lot of employers might say, well, shoot, the state's got a program, so we're not going to mess with our own program that might be more lucrative than what the state's offering. This way, it's a separate sick leave plan. They still get all their sick leave benefits from their employer and everything else, but it's their contribution, their money, and they take ownership of it, and they can build it and accumulate it over time.
So Representative, I'm going to give you one more minute, and then we got to wrap up because I've got a long list of folks.
Okay. Anyway, so it's something we had a wide range of support. I urge you to hold up on moving this bill forward and that we truly look at the amendments that we put together and get it clean and look at February or the following session to come back and actually move forward with the program that we put together. And it should be the -14A amendments when we get them up on OLIS. So.
Perfect. And Representative, really quick, just for the record, can you state your name?
State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, encompassing Yamhill and Washington County.
Perfect. Thank you, gentlemen. We have a quick. Senator Whitsitt, you have a question?
I do. In testimony yesterday, Representative Widener, Mr. Wheeler described broad involvement of the business community in the discussions of House Bill 2960. Listening carefully to his testimony, he did not suggest broad support by the business community. From your perspective, is there broad support for this bill in the business community?
I'm talking about
2960. This bill.
This bill there is not. No. So
thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, so we're going to head to our witness registration list here. Sounds like it's their title, not mine. If we do have any other elected officials, I'm going to ask them to come up as well, because we're trying to keep them on task with their committees. So starting off, Linda Bowen. Mm-hmm. Come on up, Linda. And then who do you want to have? Why don't we have you start off, and then we'll go from there.
Okay.
And again, I'm going to ask everyone if you could just really keep it to under 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Perfect.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Linda Bowen, and I am a home care provider, so I'm not involved in any of this other stuff. I'm a member of SEIU, and it's Local 503, and I'm here today to support HB 2960. I'm representing approximately 20,000 home care workers in the state of Oregon. The average age is about 31 years old. And I realize the system created by HB 2960 will benefit them more than me. I'm almost 69 years old, so hopefully I'll only have to work another 10 years or so. But I'll still benefit. And I started working as a care provider in 2005 in Southern California when I was running a group home for my father and my brother, and I was taking care of 6 people with developmental disabilities. That was my first exposure to this population, and I was working approximately 80 plus hours a week. I did it for 7 years, got kind of tired and decided to retire, and I moved back to Oregon. And I realized I could not survive just on my Social Security, which I'm sure no one does, and a small pension, I guess you'd say, from a hospital where I used to work. So now I'm a 24-hour caregiver for a developmentally disabled 56-year-old woman. She lives in the house with me, and I take care of her. I love the work I do. I enjoy her. We have a good time. But if I didn't work now at age 69, we wouldn't be able to get along on my pension and her disability. And we're not really able to save money. What little bit I put in the savings, I don't earn anything on. So what this bill does for me is give me an opportunity to put some money away, and then in 10 years, get a little bit more, another $50, $100, maybe even $200 a month would make a big difference in our life. We would be able to maybe go out. We'd like to go to the coast for a day or two or up into Washington. Right now, our big thing is going to Sherry's on Wednesday nights because it's free pie night.
Pie night.
Yeah.
That's right. I got kids. I've been there.
But I realize the people behind me, the younger ones that are working in this field and working very hard, I might add, they're really going to benefit from this because it will give them an opportunity to save money and hopefully not get into it. You know, if you put it in the bank, sometimes something comes up, new tires, whatever. You want to go and take that money out of your savings. You're not going to do that if you have a designated IRA. And I've heard good things about how the state manages retirement funds. They do a good job, I was told. So Well, don't frown. You do a good job sometimes. That's what I was told. And so I think that this is a really valid idea.
Thank you.
Okay, and so I'm hoping that you'll really consider everything that's being told to you today and yesterday and think about it and support and vote yes for this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you for coming to the Capitol. So, Senator Knope, you're up. Did I miss, is there any other electeds? Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Steiner and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity. I understand that there was some discussion, and there has been discussion about this House bill and the opportunity to have a 401k plan for the private sector. However, before we do that, I would like to refer you to the -A10 amendments, because I think if we're going to do something for the private sector, I think we should perfect it in the public sector first. And therefore, I propose the FAIR plan, which is basically a 401k for new hires for PERS. And so I think it's important, really, since the Supreme Court's decision that has tossed out the savings, most of the savings from PERS, to find avenues where we can reduce the liability of taxpayers going forward. And this is one way we can do that. The sooner you start, the more effective it will be. We have, I think, a great opportunity with some other PERS issues, but they don't particularly fit in this bill. And so I wanted to bring to your attention today that opportunity, and would encourage you to make sure that we focus on the most expensive part of government that we're dealing with right now, which is the PERS liability, and do what we can to make sure that we are doing right by all the people of Oregon in that case. And so I would urge your consideration of the -10 amendments.
Perfect. And Senator, really quick, could you give us your name for the record?
Senator Tim Knope, Central Oregon.
Perfect. Any questions for the Senator? We appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day. All right. How about if I'm going to call three folks down, DJ, Betsy, Elizabeth. Do we have three chairs up there, or do we have just two? There we go. Perfect. Sure. Welcome.
I'll go first.
Perfect.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. For the record, DJ Vogt, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. And we are here today in opposition of the House Bill 2960. Our engagement on this legislation goes back to December of last year, when we were approached by the proponents. And what we did is we convened a group of our members, business association partners, employment law experts. And what we did was we came up with a list of principles that, if included in the legislation, we believe that would make this more workable for our members and employers. Unfortunately, several key principles that we drafted have not been included in the current draft, and so therefore we remain in opposition. And I'll go into just a couple of those. I know you want to keep it short. One of which is that startup credits be included in the legislation. By that I mean basically an income tax credit to offset any costs that employers might incur for setting up a plan. Now, whether that be this state IRA type plan or a private sector 401k. We believe there should be equal treatment among retirement plans, whether they be run by the state or administered by the state or administered by a private sector entity. That's not in the bill. The second one I want to highlight is we really believe that this legislation should somehow prohibit employers from dropping an existing retirement plan in favor of this one. We don't want that to happen. We want employers to keep their retirement plans, and you know, more likely to have a 401k plan is going to be better for employees if they're currently contributing to it than this option. So minus those key principles, we are not supporting this bill, and I'm happy to take questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Betsy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 2960. And since I know you're in a hurry, I'm going to spare you the statements about sweeping mandates and unchecked government government power and control, and just share with you that the main concern that AOI has about this bill, besides the fact that we think it will impose setup costs on the state that are probably premature, is the fact that it's our position and belief that the auto enrollment provision in 2960 will trigger ERISA liability on employers and the state. And that's something that concerns us greatly. We have information from the information that was received by the Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force from the U.S. Department of Labor in June of last year does indicate that the auto enroll provision, regardless of the fact that employees can opt out later, turns this into an ERISA-covered plan. And I think that's our main concern. If you do decide to proceed with a bill such as this, there are a couple of sideboards that we would really appreciate seeing. One is that before the board goes ahead and sets up a plan, they conduct a feasibility analysis that shows that the plan that they end up proposing would be fiscally self-sustaining and not require general fund subsidies. Again, we would like to obtain an advisory opinion from Department of Labor indicating for the specific plan that's proposed that there's not a trigger of ERISA. And we would like to have an opinion from the IRS confirming that the savings vehicles that are in the proposed plan would receive favorable tax treatment. Finally, we'd like for the board to submit the plan to the legislature for review, fiscal analysis, and approval so that there's a kind of a clawback or just a sort of oversight of the board and not that it is kind of out there on their own.
Perfect. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Howell, here representing the Portland Business Alliance. PBA shares the concern and the goal of increasing retirement savings for Oregonians. However, at the same time, we believe the state should leave a small footprint when entering into competition with the private sector. So as DJ mentioned, we worked with our business community partners and join in agreement of the principles that were developed. I'll highlight a couple others that DJ didn't cover that we still remain concerned about. One is that the state should express support for more robust private sector retirement savings vehicles. The IRA that is likely to be the result of the board's decision offered in this program is not substantial enough to provide adequate savings in retirement. An IRA is an adequate vehicle, substandard to a 401k, which is the traditional type of plan provided by employers, which leads to the concern that this plan will actually incentivize employers to use the state's IRA plan rather than setting up their own 401k through the private sector, especially if the board determines that a tax credit or other incentive is appropriate to offset administrative costs for employers who are using the state's plan, and that state that same incentive is not provided to companies to employers who wish to provide a robust 401k plan, it really drives employers to use a substandard vehicle for their employees' retirement savings. So that's our main concern and principle that's not yet been met. We do appreciate that the bill included a preemption so that there will not be lots of local communities requiring different sorts of policies in different jurisdictions across the state. We believe workplace policies like this are best handled at the state level, so we do appreciate that that's been included. So.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, then Senator Whitsitt.
I apologize. I had to testify on another bill, but I would pose this question to any of the three of you, and I don't know, a couple of you were in the room yesterday. I used an example of expectations that I witnessed firsthand in my husband's company. And on contemplating this bill and expecting today's hearing, I wonder if any of the three of you have an opinion about whether or not employees put in these plans would have any reason to believe that they were in a plan that has been described as richly as PERS. I think the chair asked the question of managing expectations. Some of these plans are going to grow very, very slowly, and I think people could be easily disappointed. They read in the newspaper about other government-provided programs with rich benefits. What's the possibility that there could be a generalized misunderstanding of the outcome of retirement plans in an environment where interest is artificially low right now? And I just wonder whether there would be consumer confusion to a degree that people are going to feel genuinely aggrieved as they watch their account balances change.
I'll go first or take that one. Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I believe that's a very distinct possibility that consumer expectations would be high, given it's technically a state-administered program. I wish my 401ks had done as well as the PERS fund, quite frankly. But those are professionally managed funds, no matter if it's a 401k or if it's the PERS fund. But your concern is real, and I personally would think that if I was entering into a state-administered plan, that I may have higher expectations than actually markets could deliver for such a plan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You've all expressed concerns and suggestions that were made on the genesis of this bill. So to what extent, if any, were your association's concerns or suggestions incorporated into the text of Senate Bill 2960A?
You should probably take that. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I don't think that any of the principles that the group that AOI participated in were adopted by the original bill, in the base bill that you're looking at today. Is that?
Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, our groups, the principles, I believe, are on OLIS at this point. Some were addressed, and I would say that the most important one that was addressed was statewide preemption of local ordinances creating such policies. Very important. It was addressed. And there is language around educating people around retirement, financial literacy. Language could be stronger. I believe there's differing legal opinions around whether ERISA will be triggered or not. But there is an attempt to not trigger in there. So I count that as being addressed. But all of the principles certainly were not, and two of which I highlighted in my testimony.
Thank you very much.
And I would have to add, Senator Whitsitt, that we would count, AOI would count ERISA as having not been addressed. So I think it's kind of a matter of how you look at it.
Mr.
One
Chair,
last comment.
Senator Whitsitt, if I could also add, because of the differing legal opinions around ERISA, obviously that's an issue that's hard to settle. But PBA doesn't feel that our liability has been completely addressed. There's a may instead of a shall in the language that causes us to wonder whether if ERISA were triggered, the whole plan would actually be canceled, or if it's kind of optional that it's canceled. So that is a concern that we still have with the language.
Right. Thank you very
Wait,
much.
Wait, before they go, one more.
Yeah, one last.
He gets a follow-up.
We got a follow-up. Got it.
Yes.
All right.
In testimony yesterday, we heard, I believe, from the treasurer that there has been no definitive answer on the ERISA question. Is that your understanding?
Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, that is our understanding, that
there's
no definitive answer.
All righty.
Wait.
Oh, there you go, Senator.
Yesterday there was testimony about enforcement. I think Senator Beyer said that this would be on the honor system, and I still remain deeply confused about where people that felt aggrieved would call. And someone, I forget who, mentioned that the default position might be enforcement and administration at BOLI. How comfortable would your members be if that became the default enforcement agency?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, while we appreciate the work that BOLI does in Oregon, I think that it wouldn't provide a great deal of comfort for us. And part of the reason for that is that the labor commissioner we have now, as reasonable as he might be, is not going to be the labor commissioner forever. That position in particular has kind of gone back and forth as to how easy they are to work with.
All righty. Thank you very much. Representative Frederick, did you want to come up and share some thoughts with us?
Okay. I'm just here to listen in on something else altogether.
Oh, all right. All right. You're welcome to come up and sit up here with us if you'd like. All right. Tom, Elise, and Jan, come on up.
co-chairs, members of the committee, Elise Brown, and I'm here for SIFMA, which is the National Trade Association, Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. But I'm also here today to represent John Mangan. It was our hope he was going to be able to dial in this afternoon, and that was not the case. So I'm going to yield my time and my comments because his comments are very important, and I'm going to read his testimony with your permission. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan, and I'm Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers. Our member companies include Standard of Oregon, State Farm, Farmers, Liberty Life, and about 300 other providers of retirement plans. I'm the ACLI's national issue person for the state-sponsored retirement plan, so I'm aware of other state actions. I appreciate your willingness to hear from me on the phone via Elise Brown, since I'm unable to travel right now. I will keep this brief and focus on correcting some of the statements that were made yesterday. This proposal, House Bill 2960, represents an enormous and so far unprecedented undertaking affecting tens of thousands of employers and perhaps half a million Oregonians. The committee is right to review it carefully and get all the facts. In answer to a question from Senator Johnson, it was stated that California, Illinois have implemented a state-sponsored plan for private workers. That is incorrect. No state has implemented such a plan or enrolled a single person. The fact is states are deeply concerned about the significant legal, administrative, cost, and liability issues in these proposals. California, Connecticut, and Illinois are each undergoing significant due diligence process before allowing implementation. And that due diligence includes requiring a DOL opinion to be obtained confirming that the plan would not be subject to ERISA. California and Connecticut are also required to show that the plan will be fiscally self-sustaining and will not require general fund subsidies. And the legislature gets to review the plan and its costs one more time before it's implemented. None of these due diligence steps are required in House Bill 2960, which is our primary concern with the bill. Our proposed amendments, which simply mirror the California and Connecticut requirements for oversight and accountability, would cure these concerns, and we urge you to reconsider them. The fact is no other state has proposed to have the legislature delegate to a state board the power to design, create, and implement a mandatory retirement plan without performing this critical due diligence and without further fiscal or legislative oversight. The board can cause the automatic enrollment of up to 650,000 Oregonians. If the board puts that money in a typical pre-tax IRA fund, the general fund will lose that tax revenue. The board can even make rules disqualifying current plans and extending the employer mandate, again, without oversight. We think this delegation of power creates a serious lack of transparency and accountability and is imprudent. ERISA is the key issue, and you should not
proceed. You've got 30 seconds, and then I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. This is important. It was stated yesterday that K&L Gates has produced a legal memo that concludes a plan like Oregon's is exempt. We have separate legal opinions from Davis and Harmon in Washington, D.C. that conclude the opposite. These legal memos have been presented to the task force and to each of the policy committees. They address the Oregon plan proposed and the plan described in the task force and the safe harbor issues raised by the treasurer's office yesterday. These are credible, legal,
huge issues, and
I'm wrapping up right now. Again, it was our intent to have him here in person. There's several more paragraphs that you're missing, but I'm happy to follow up with each of you in the absence of his presence.
It would be wonderful if you'd get us your comments. Submit them to us. Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I presume when you say your comments, you're speaking about Mr. Mangan's letter. I think that is imperative to have out in this discussion, particularly with the potential downside for the general fund. And there seems to be kind of a vapor lock in this building about how bad 17-19 is going to be, given the PERS decision. We're all walking around thinking, well, we didn't get whacked in 15-17, so it's all okay. It's not going to be okay. And if there is a general fund obligation that would accompany this into this next upcoming critical biennium, I think that's worthy of much deeper conversation before this bill moves forward.
co-chairs and Senator Johnson. Since I just received it again, we were hoping to have him on the phone, but I'll make sure it's submitted to OLIS.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Simpson. I'm the Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for Standard Insurance. Standard is a 100-year-old Oregon-headquartered company. We sell life insurance, sell disability, and for the purposes of this discussion, we sell retirement plans to employers nationwide. We have 7 million customers that we cover. In 2014, we were nationally recognized as being a top five employer a provider of employer plans and employer retirement plans, and we received 24 best-in-class awards from our peers. So this is an expert. This is an area where we are experts. Last summer at the Retirement Savings Task Force, Joe Canary, director of the Office of Regulations and Interpretations at the U.S. Department of Labor, stated that ERISA is, quote, a system designed to provide requirements for running plans, to make sure the plans are run properly, that the benefits that are promised are secure and provided in accordance to the law and terms of the plan. Get that. This is a purpose that we at the Standard agree with and work hard to ensure that it protects our customers. This plan you have in front of you is bending over backwards to try to avoid ERISA. It is going out of its way to ensure that ERISA does not apply. Why is the state working so hard to avoid these basic protections? You wouldn't do this with the Clean Water Act. You wouldn't do this with the Endangered Species Act or the Clean Air Act. This body may grumble about the costs imposed by federal regulations and protections, but it tries to abide by them to protect Oregonians. Why is this case any different? Why wouldn't we want to protect Oregonians? We know what it takes to abide by ERISA and what the costs look like, and we are well acquainted with how it protects Americans and their hard-earned savings. The question is, how does Oregon create opportunities for its citizens to save money in a robust retirement plan while also being protected by ERISA? Such a plan would likely be a 401k that offers auto enrollment, auto escalation, and employer match. Employers would be incented, not mandated, not forced, to participate. It goes much further down the road of providing a secure retirement for Oregonians. It will fall under ERISA, and it should fall under ERISA. The real question for this body is how to move the small employer market toward this kind of plan while taking into consideration the costs and liabilities they may incur. This bill mandates a low-yield IRA that promises a secure retirement it cannot possibly deliver on, seeking to fall outside the protections of ERISA for 500,000 Oregonians. This is not good public policy. We should not, as a state, seek to direct low- and middle-income employees into a subpar retirement plan while the market is full of much better options.
Thank you. Oh, we have a question here, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna focus for a minute on rather the details of how the plan is structured and more on, to use your phrase, and what the objective is, retirement security mm-hmm. for Oregonians. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your firm covers 7 million customers nationwide.
Mm-hmm, correct.
I'd like for you to provide me any information you may have at your fingertips today about how many customers you have in Oregon, how many of what percent of Oregon workers you cover, and what the average wage is. If you could give me a sense of that. In other words, mm-hmm. what's the profile of your typical customer? One of the issues we're trying to address here is a tremendous number of Oregonians who lack retirement savings and lack retirement security. And so how have you been providing it to how many Oregonians? Mm-hmm. Who are they? And over time, are you covering a greater percentage of Oregonians, or is it sort of flat? Because it seems to me that we, leaving things the way they are, the status quo has just not been satisfactory. We still have a tremendous proportion of Oregonians not covered. Or can you show us a trend line that either your company or the private sector is quickly changing that?
Chair Smith and Representative Nathanson, that's not information I have right in front of me. We're going to have to dig that out. What we do know in Oregon, and when I talk to my sales, the sales force that's out there on the streets, is that the economy in Oregon has been very tough, and it's and there's not a lot of small businesses that are growing very rapidly. So it's been difficult for them to sell more plans in Oregon precisely because of that. And one of the biggest challenges a lot of small employers have is that where do they spend the next dollar? Do they spend it on this? They spend it on healthcare? Where do they spend it? And that's a very difficult decision. It's not that they don't want to spend it on retirement. It's just that they've only got a dollar. So and perhaps maybe other testimony can shed more light on the small employer market or small employers and what they're thinking. I can't do that, but I'll certainly look into getting you this data.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you. In a former and much better life, I'm a veterinarian, had a veterinary practice supply store, had 18 to 25 employees, had a medical health care plan, a profit share plan, and a ERISA sanctioned retirement plan for my employees. So I guess my question is, over 30 years, the economy went up and went down. We were able to maintain all that. Mm-hmm. So why would a state-sponsored ERISA-exempt plan have been better for my employees?
Chair Smith, Senator Wetsit, I'm not sure I completely understand your question, but I think it's that you're assuming that I'm in favor of the current plan.
No.
We're not.
No, I understand that. Neither am I. I'm just saying why, had this law been in place when mm-hmm. I was in business, why would it have been better for my employees to be enrolled in this plan, this ERISA exempt plan, than in my own plan?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Wetsit, it would not. I believe this plan is in front of you is a low yield plan. That it promises something I don't believe it will be able to deliver on, which is it talks about secure retirement. It talks about some kind of future benefit. I just don't think it's going to be something, but it won't give you the kind of yields you would get on a 401k.
And just for the record, that plan that we had mm-hmm. applied to, it was a 1 year to get invested in the plan, and after that it didn't make any difference whether you were a kennel worker or a veterinarian. You had the same benefits.
Thank you. Jan,
thank you.
Just introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We've been advocating on behalf of small businesses since 1943. We have about 350,000 members nationwide and about 7,000 small privately owned businesses throughout the entire state of Oregon. We recognize the problem. It's a problem not only for employees, but it's a problem for our small business employers. And I've never talked to a small business owner that ever said, I don't want a retirement plan for my employees, or I don't want a retirement plan for myself. They all recognize the problem. It's a matter of economics. We have small businesses that offer very generous 401k plans. One has 36 employees and only 8 participate. Another has a very generous plan and only 20% of the employees participate. Why? Because they're living paycheck to paycheck. Costs are going up. The metro area is a very expensive place to live. We definitely recognize the problem and we would like to be part of the solution. 2960 we do not feel is a part of the solution. For our small businesses, it actually creates a problem. And what is that problem? One of it is that it's a mandated burden upon small businesses. And we are already looking and talking about multiple mandated burdens upon small businesses this session. And in the area of compliance, reporting, potential fiduciary liability, and no study has been done of this prior to the bill reaching this point after having been, the task force was initiated in 2013, and we still haven't had that studied. Potential cannibalization of existing plans, private retirement plans, if they are not qualified by the estate adjudication. What is the state adjudication? We don't know. That will be determined by the board. Some 401k plans, like if the state plan starts on day one, and other 401k pay plans start at 90 days or 6 months or a year. Does that mean they won't be qualified? We don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions. Then proceeding to spend taxpayer dollars when the foundational ERISA question has not been answered. We believe the plan as represented in HB 2960 would trigger ERISA. And that's a tremendous undertaking when the foundational platform question on this entire bill has not been answered. There's been continual mischaracterization that HB 2960 is similar to the College 529 plan. Well, there's a very significant difference. The 529 plan does not mandate employers to enroll all of their employees.
Thank you very much.
And I have more. I'll leave it at that.
Feel free to submit it to our committee. Senator Johnson.
I can't help but look at Mr. Harris sitting in the audience and recalling that at one time he ran DAS, and DAS, Department of Administrative Services, is in charge of risk management for the state. I would invite any of the three of you to comment whether or not there's any downside risk to the state in terms of claims of exaggerated returns. You raised the issue of retirement security for Oregonians. You think there's any downside risk for ostensibly false advertising?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I would certainly say yes. It seems to be, when we call this secure choice in California, and here it's about a secure retirement, when someone's a medium wage person is, say, putting aside 3% of their income, by the time they get out to retirement, that's not going to be very big. And it would be unlikely for them to have a secure retirement at that point. So who are they going to come back to? Are they going back to their employer? They might. They could come back to the state because it was a state plan. So,
With your permission, Mr. Chair, I guess I would nuance my question even more, given that we have made it much easier in this state to form class action lawsuits. Will this end up being the mother of all class action lawsuits, in your opinion?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I certainly hope not, but I would, on the risk side, I would have to say that is one very big concern that we would have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your thoughts. All right, so I just have two more folks who want to testify. Lee, you want to come on down, and then Joyce. Joyce, I think you're going to be replacing John Bartholomew.
Yeah.
So welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Smith. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the committee. My name is Lee Mercer. I'm a retired small business owner and a member of the executive team of Main Street Alliance of Oregon. My wife and I also run a small pet boarding and grooming facility that offers retirement to all our qualified employees. So I'm in a similar business to Senator Whitsitt. Kind of. My wife, Main Street Alliance is a network of over 2,500 small businesses around the state engaging on policy impacting our businesses and our communities. Main Street Alliance of Oregon supports HB 2960A to create an Oregon Retirement Savings Board to design a defined contribution retirement plan to improve the retirement security of the employees of private businesses throughout Oregon. As small business owners, it is a challenge to provide adequate benefits to employees, retirement benefits. Many of us have neither the time nor the money to invest in creating adequate retirement plans. As a result, half of all private sector employees are not participating in an employer-based retirement plan, and amongst Oregon's smallest employers, less than one-third of all employees participate. The result is that low and middle-income Oregonians are relying on Social Security for between 70% and 80% of their retirement income. We all know that Social Security will not provide enough to pay the bills during our retirement years. I know, because I retired a year or two ago. When I was surveying 443 small business owners around the state of Oregon, from Astoria to Lakeview and from Joseph to Brookings, in the years 2013 and 2014, we learned that 85% of these small businesses have no retirement plan for their employees, and nearly 40% have no retirement for themselves. Many quipped, "You are looking at my retirement," indicating that their only assets were the inventory and fixtures of their businesses. But of this sampling of 443 small businesses around rural Oregon, 71% would support a pooled retirement option like HB 2960. Many small business owners would like to offer retirement investment options to their employees, but currently find it difficult and cost prohibitive. By creating a uniform, accessible, statewide solution, HB 2960A will make it easier for businesses to offer retirement investment plans to their employees. By not acting to improve security, retirement security in Oregon, the state will incur more safety net costs in the long run as more and more Oregonians, employees, and employers alike retire into poverty. Main Street Alliance of Oregon enthusiastically supports HB 2960 and urges a vote in the affirmative on this important legislation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Joyce DeMonin, Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Center Hayward. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm with AARP Oregon. I'm the Outreach Director, and I lead our economic security efforts on behalf of our 500,000 members in the state of Oregon in every one of your communities. As you know, we are in a retirement crisis in Oregon, and we don't believe that the current products and services that have been offered and are available now are anywhere close to meeting the needs of Oregonians. We have a survey that we did in 2013 that showed 61% of Oregonians were anxious about having enough money to live on comfortably in retirement, which makes perfect sense since our study also indicated that if you don't have retirement savings at work for people 45 to 65, your average retirement savings is $5,000. And you just can't get there from there. You know, the reality is, Oregonians, this has been a problem. We've been kicking down the road for a number of years, and it's time that we did something to solve it. You know, we see as more and more boomers hit age 65, we're seeing in Oregon the haves and the have-nots, the people who have a retirement plan and the 642,000 Oregonians without one. And it really creates a disparity in our state. You're all aware that the state is facing about $140 million shortfall in the Department of Human Services budget. But imagine if we don't solve this retirement crisis now, what those human services budgets would look like and the demand for services in years to come. It's going to be a big problem, and I think it's up to leadership to be a leader and do something about it. So AARP believes that House Bill 2960 is a common sense solution to help people save their own money. And there has been no promise about a rate of return. It's not a PERS. No one has ever said that except for a few people in the building. No one, their bill doesn't say that. The advocates don't say that. So if anyone's saying that, it has nothing to do with this bill. About ERISA, we couldn't disagree more with the people you've heard. Our experts, and we have a lot of attorneys in Washington, D.C. who work very closely with the Department of Labor, believe that this is a very carefully crafted bill that has been very thoughtfully vetted. It's been very thoughtfully vetted by AARP and all of our pension law attorneys. We're very supportive of this bill and what it's been doing. In addition, the Department of Labor has offered to work with the state of Oregon on this situation, and we have a couple of years to deal with it, so we're not in some kind of imminent crisis, as was indicated. The other thing I want to bring to your attention.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. I have submitted to you a survey that was released by AARP yesterday, scientifically valid. This is not my opinion. This is not my members. This is a scientifically valid survey that shows nearly 60% of Oregon small businesses support this bill, and even more of them support the concepts outlined in this bill. An even higher percentage of Oregonians support this concept. So please, we urge your yes vote.
Thank you so much. Senator Johnson.
Given that you pointed your remark at me, I want to correct this on the record.
Okay.
In no way am I equating this to PERS, but I am saying that there is a vast pool of unsophisticated savers out there who may not be able to differentiate one state benefit from another.
Well, I've heard that comment from others, so it's not meant to be targeted specifically to you.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The AARP, as well as SEIU, has been Service Employee International Union, has been strong advocates of this same bill or almost identical bills in every state where it's been introduced, and yet it has never been adopted and implemented in any state in the union. Why should Oregon be first if the 49 other states have concluded it's not something they want to do?
Well, I think currently there are 20 states in the country who are looking at this bill. Illinois passed a bill.
I'm aware they're looking at it. No one has passed it.
Illinois passed a bill in January.
And they have not implemented it.
That's true, because it just passed.
Nor has California.
Right. And then, of course, California passed their study, was it a couple of years ago? And they've raised the money to do their feasibility study, so they're moving forward on it.
Mm-hmm. So it is correct that no state has implemented this plan, and no state has enrolled a single employee at this point.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
All right. Thank you very
much.
You're
welcome.
All right. So we've gone through our list of folks who want to testify. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2960. And I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2960.
Mr. Chair, I will save the co-chair the trip, and I'll go get Senator Devlin. I am a no on this bill, and so we are engaging in the time-honored tradition of rolling members in ways and means. And I am going to go get the co-chair, who will substitute for my vote.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
And Mr. Co-chair, while the good senator is on her sojourn, will the committee be entertaining any motions for amendments to this bill?
Senator, good question. I do not believe that the rules allow for us to introduce amendments but for pre-approved by the co-chairs, is my understanding. I would seek clarification.
That's what I've been told as well, and that the co-chair is coming in as we speak.
Yeah, so, Mr. Co-chair, I just want to, the question has been asked, are amendments in Ways and Means allowed? My understanding is, by rule, amendments can only be allowed if they're pre-approved by the co-chairs.
Oh, my goodness. Getting into a very complex subject that...
Mr. Co-chair, we'll follow your lead on this.
Well, I'm not so sure I should be at liberty. By practice, amendments are not allowed in subcommittees unless they are approved by the co-chairs.
That's my understanding.
However, as you may recall, in recent history, we've had amendments offered before the full. And that went through a very deliberative process about whether those were permissible. And I think it came down because of the rules within the two chambers. And I'm speaking out of turn here because I don't have a set of attorneys with me or the chief clerk or the secretary of the Senate, that amendments we would have to actually if an amendment is offered by a member of the committee and full, the committee will need to take an action on it. Now, they could take any action that's permissible under normal rule. They could vote to table the amendment. They could pass the amendment. They could defeat the amendment. So it'd be under the normal process. But because we've had this experience, I think my memory is correct, not that long ago, I think that we could see it actually happen in this full also.
Yeah, my understanding is in the subs they have to be pre-approved, but in the full is an opportunity.
Yeah. The second portion of this is, and because I don't think any levity is needed in this meeting, but all of these bills are off the agenda tomorrow for full, so full will be a very simple full committee for those of you that are on full committee. I am chairing tomorrow. Should these come the following week, Representative Buckley will be chairing the committee. I just wanted to put that on the record.
No, how well that goes could depend on what your vote is. Never mind.
So, Senator, what I'm going to ask is if you have an amendment to introduce, would you be willing to bring it to full?
If I understood the answer, it would be out of order in the subcommittee.
Are you okay with
that?
Thank
you. Yeah.
Okay.
And
all
also,
right.
it would be important if an amendment is going to be offered in the full. And you should probably check with Legislative Fiscal Office, Fiscal Officer, and maybe with the Secretary of the Senate, too. That the amendment is available to the public a certain time and obviously hopefully available to the members a certain time before, because it would still have to meet all the posting requirements.
Perfect. All right. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash A9 amendment to House Bill 2960.
So Madam Co-Chair moves adoption of the A9 amendments to House Bill 2960. Is there any discussion on this motion? Is there any opposition to this motion? Let it be known that Senator Whitsitt and Representative Hurd are in opposition. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2960 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as modified by the Dash A9 amendment.
Right. Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 2960 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as modified by the A9 amendments. Is there any discussion on this? Is there any opposition? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Comp?
Thank you. After being in the hearing all day yesterday and today, I think a tremendous amount of good questions have been asked. I am going to vote yes on this bill, but I think there's some key pieces that do need to be added, or the Treasurer's office needs to get on to rulemaking very quickly to make sure that the goals of this bill are happening.
Thank you. Are there any other comments, colleagues? All righty. Is there any opposition to this? Let it be seen, Senator Whitsitt and Representative Hurd. See no other opposition. The measure is passed. Taking it to full Ways and Means will be Representative Reed, and then he'll carry it on the House floor as well, and then on the Senate floor it'll be Senator Beyer.
Beyer.
Yeah.
And can you please note that Senator Johnson was excused for this?
Yeah, and let it be known that or recognize Senator Johnson is excused. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. All righty. We're closing the work session on House Bill 2960. We're going to be opening up a work session. Hey, don't leave us. Now the exciting bills are coming. Where are you guys going? All right. We're opening up a work session on House Bill 5038, the Board of Tax Practitioners. Okay. What do we need to know on this?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 5038 is the budget bill for the Board of Tax Practitioners. This is a current service level budget. It authorizes $1,242,678 in other funds, four positions, and four FTE, and it represents a 5% increase from the 2013-2015 legislatively approved budget. There is one package in the budget. It's an LFO analyst adjustment package. The board had voted to temporarily reduce their license fees by $10. And so this package adjusts the revenues down by $95,480 other funds to reflect the temporary reduction in license fees. So that leaves revenues at ending fund balance of $268,152, which calculates to an equivalent of 5.18 months of operating expenditures.
Perfect. All right. Oh, we're going to hear about Kate. Would you like a motion now or to wait?
It's up to you.
I'll wait.
Okay. All right. The KPMs, there are no adjustments to the KPMs, so the LFO recommendation is to approve as they are.
Perfect. Julie, would you mind just very, very quickly giving Senator Johnson a courtesy call to let her know that we're voting on these bills?
Far.
Yeah. If you can. I don't. All right, so Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to find the right document. Sorry about that. Ms. McDowell, good. Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5038.
All right, Madam Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5038. Is there any comments, colleagues? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so adopted. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the LFO recommendation on key performance measures to House Bill 5038.
Alrighty, Madam Co-Chair moves the key performance measures to House Bill 5038. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so adopted. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 5038 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 5038 to the full joint committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Colleagues, is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so passed. Who would like to carry this?
Okay.
Senator Witzel, will you carry this? Thank you. All righty. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 5038. We're good with that? I'm closing? All right.
Do we have a carrier for the House chamber?
I'll carry it on the House floor.
Okay.
Is there anyone who would want to carry this on the House floor?
I got mine next week.
You just go right ahead.
Actually, I'm going to ask Representative Hurd
to carry this. Yeah, I think that's a good plan.
On the floor.
Jeez. All right. Come on, Dad.
Practice makes perfect, Representative Hurd.
All right. Thank you, Representative. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm opening up now the work session on House Bill, and let it be known that Senator Johnson was excused. Okay. And we're going to open up the work session on House Bill 5001, Advocacy Commission.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 5001 is the budget bill for the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office. The bill authorizes $646,781 in total funds, three positions, and 2.5 FTE. This represents a 38.7% increase from the 2013-2015 legislatively approved budget. And this is a small budget, which is why that seems so significant with the 38% increase. The first package in the budget is Package 101, labeled Growing Interagency Collaboration, and this is to reclassify an existing executive support specialist position that's a 1.0 FTE, and this is at a cost of $5,895 general fund, and the LFO recommendation is to approve that package. And the next package, Package 102, Increasing Oregon Advocacy Commission Policy Research and Advocacy. The LFO recommendation is to approve the package with adjustments to establish an operations and policy analyst 3 at a 0.5 FTE at a cost of $117,219 in general fund. And this is permanently establishing the position at a 0.5 FTE. And on to KPMs. The KPMs, there are no recommendations to make changes. So the LFO recommendation is to approve as they are. And then this budget does require an amendment to the bill, which is the Dash 1 amendment, and it deletes the appropriation of $1 million that was in there before and inserts $646,781 for that. Is that.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5001.
Madam Co-Chair moves LFO's recommendation to House Bill 5001. Is there any discussion?
I'm going to represent.
Oh, represent Com.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Steiner Hayward. I'm going to share my disappointment that this increase was not more. There's been a number of years where the Advocacy Commission had no support services whatsoever, and these commissions serve a huge purpose, and they're just doing a wonderful job. And sincerely, commissions. I might be wrong with that, but for two people to handle all those meetings and to keep up with what they're doing and bringing forth legislation. The Women's Commission brought forward a bill this session with Senator Moynihan Anderson about pay equity for women. And I mean, it's not like we're sitting around and putting on makeup and having a party. I just want to share that I wish this figure was higher.
Madam Co-Chair.
I would largely echo Representative Comp's comments. I pushed pretty hard to try to fund more of the POPs. And to be honest, given the Supreme Court's decision last week, I now have mixed feelings. I think from a fiscally prudent perspective, I'd rather be more conservative this biennium and not have to yank things away from people next biennium when our funding situation is going to be dramatically worse than it is now. But in principle, I couldn't agree with you more, Representative Comp. And I admire the work that Ms. Baker and her colleagues and the board chairs have been doing. I think they add an important amount of value to the state. And I hope that in the long term, we can continue to grow their capability to bring forward the concerns of women and African Americans and Asian Pacific Islanders and Latino community. So going forward, who knows? Better financial times, maybe we can do more. But we are where we are right now, and I think this is the fiscally prudent thing to do this year.
All righty. Any other comments, colleagues? Yeah, Senator Whitta.
Thank you. In lieu of the PERS court decision and the looming billion-dollar hole in the Oregon Health Authority a year from now, I'm not going to be supporting any increases in general fund appropriations unless they have a lot better reason this one does, in my opinion, so I'll be a no.
Thank you. All righty. Any other comments, colleagues? Chris, I need help. Remind me what my motion is that I'm
just the first one.
All right. Madam Co-Chair has moved the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5001. We've had our discussions. Colleagues, is there, Senator Whitsitt, you're going to be in opposition, so let that be noted for the record. Is there any other opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on the key performance measures to House Bill 5001.
All righty. Madam Co-Chair moves the key performance measures to House Bill 5001. Is there any discussion, okay, colleagues? Any opposition? Seeing none, so approved.
I did say dash one.
I thought we had an amendment.
I think it's dash two.
Well,
pardon me. Let
that's
me look.
The next one, but we have to clear up whether it's the dash one or the dash two. We have a minor glitch.
All right. So we're going to get this figured out here.
Mr. Chair, while they're clarifying, may I just, when we're done with this particular set of motions, I would respectfully ask for the opportunity to vote on 5038.
Yep, we'll get you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 5001.
All right. Madam Co-Chair moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 5001. Any discussion, colleagues? Any opposition? Seeing none, so approved. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 5001 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 5001 to the full joint committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended. That is important to remember that. Any discussion on this? Any opposition? Let it be noted, Senator Whitsitt is a no. Any other opposition, colleagues? All right. So approved. Our carrier is going to be Senator Winters on Fall, and on the House side, it's going to be Representative Frederick.
Thanks, Frederick.
And on the Senate side,
Senator
Flores.
Senator Winters can take it.
All right, we'll keep it with Senator Winters. All righty. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 5001. We're good?
Yep.
All right, it's closed. I'm going to ask Senator Johnson, do you have a motion you want us to entertain for your to allow you to vote on House Bill 5038?
Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask the opportunity to vote on House Bill 5038.
Perfect. Colleagues, any opposition? Seeing none, of course. Senator Johnson?
Senator Johnson votes aye.
Perfect. Let it be noted for the record, Senator Johnson is an aye on House Bill 5038.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe that your co-chair helped disabuse me of the notion that the tax practitioners had a time and material contract. And I just wanted to say that she was courteous enough to reconcile that for me, and I appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank Ms. McDowell because she's the one who did the research and provided it for me. So it was a team effort.
Cool.
And just really quick, while you were out of the room, Senator Johnson, we asked you to be the carrier of House Bill 2960. Just teasing. All right.
Yeah. You're the only guy in there, Coach. I was impressed.
All right, colleagues. Any other business before us today? All right. Krista, we're good?
Yep.
All right. Julie, we're good? All right. We are going to be adjourned. Have a great day.
Looks so nice in your sight.
We are going to be adjourned. Have a great day.
Looks so nice in your sight.